morning, everyone, and welcome to the show, Alternative Health and Wellness. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us tonight live on Sedona Talk Radio, Blog Talk Radio, and we are also archived on iTunes and soon to be coming, hopefully, on iHeartRadio. Wouldn't that be exciting? So thank you so much for joining us this evening. We have a great topic tonight. We're going to be talking about taking responsibility, stepping up. You know, even some, I think a lot of people will say, taking responsibility. Oh, those words just give me cringe. You know, I don't want to take any more responsibility than I already have. Or it seems like that's all I ever do is take responsibility. So we're going to be defining those words and looking at them from different points of view and seeing, you know, where you fit in, how your life is doing, and maybe you need to step up, step back, or take a little bit more, a little bit less responsibility. You just never know these days. So it is going to be a great show. Tonight my guest is Dr. John Izzo. He is a speaker and author of Stepping Up, How Taking Responsibility Changes Everything. And I think that's very important because he tells us more from a business aspect. And also he's a very well-known speaker. And when I look at things, we look in the healthcare venue and then we say, you know, your life out there is always your life out there, your business or your work. And then I look at it and say, but your life inside you is how that's reflecting. And how you are interacting in these two worlds called your internal and your external are really, it has a lot to do about your value of your life, the health of your life, the health of your relationships, and just everything that goes on in all around you. You know, we say, I don't want to take on any more than I can. And we turn around, we say, we have terrible back pain. Well, of course you do. You feel like the load is just too heavy. Or we turn around and we say, you know, if I just sit back and don't say anything, and these people are ones that have throat cancer. They never want to talk. They can't find their voice. Where's their power? So tonight we're going to be talking about taking responsibility in a kinder, easier way. I'm calling it that. Sure, John won't, but we're going to be saying about how can you do it so that it is effective. You know, we don't want to be stepping up and taking responsibility and going out there and having a lot of, for lack of a better word, we don't want to have a whole lot of piss in our vinegar. We don't want to be spewing things. We don't want to be saying things that really shouldn't be said that are hurting other people. You know, we really want to be effective. We don't want to just take on the gauntlet, I'm going to do it, get out of my way idea. So, John, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I think it's going to be a great show, and I think I'm so pleased to have you with us today. I know you've been away and out on a lot of events.
Well, thank you. Great to be here and looking forward to an invigorating conversation, and I think one that will make a real difference for the listeners. So hang in there. I think you won't be disappointed.
And we'll be random all the way around the circle.
Sounds good.
Because we always come back to it. And, you know, I always like to draw things into the health field because people say, oh, well, I see that, but it's not really important to me. But then, as I said in the beginning, you say, where are these things coming from? Well, hey, they didn't just jump up in the air, you know. How are you handling your life? So I'm sure you see it from that side and I see it from the other side. So we'll have a great hour.
Indeed.
Great. So can you give us a little bit information about what you call responsibility? Because, you know, a lot of people, as I've said in the beginning, they really find this that it's, oh, that word, you know? And everybody goes, ooh, and then they bend forward. You know, it's like a load they have to carry.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I think when you hear a book title like, Stepping Up, How Taking Responsibility Changes Everything, the first thing that comes to mind undoubtedly for people is a parental finger wagging at you saying, you know, take responsibility, you irresponsible drone. When in fact, as I say in the very beginning of the book, I have a very different message, and that is that the moment that we take 100% responsibility, that we stop worrying about what anyone else is doing, and see ourselves as the agent of change and ask the question, I wonder what part I'm playing and I wonder what I can do. We are now in a place of tremendous power because we can't change anything else. The moment we realize, and in my book I talk about a simple concept, and I'm sure we'll get into it, of 100% responsibility, no excuses. And whenever people hear that, they get really nervous about the no excuses. People want to take responsibility, but, you know, no excuses. And we'll talk about that, but I'll give a little opening foray and just say that when we stop focusing on the excuses of why we can't do something or why we're stuck in any particular place or why we can't change something in an organization, in a society, or in our lives, we're in a place of disempowerment. So I want to say that taking responsibility is the ultimate act of empowering yourself not to be in a victim place. And that's really what the book is about. And I think we'll get into it, but amazing things happen in society, in organizations, in relationships when we're in that place.
And I think we really have to focus, too, on the concept that you can have change and you step up and take responsibility and that every person is vitally important in that system. But we always say, I'm going to stop climate change, global warming or whatever, let's say. And you say, oh, well, I can't do that. But I think you have to say there's 10,000 bazillion steps between the end of global warming and you. So if you can make any of those steps, that's moving forward. You don't go backward. You move forward, right? So do you think that those are steps?
Yeah, you know, in the book, we talk about this idea of do something, do anything. One of my chapters is titled that. And it applies in almost every realm, you know. So let's take the example you gave. I'm incredibly passionate about climate change, climate instability, global warming, which is probably a better description, by the way, climate instability, because then people get it. We've been dependent on a very stable climate, and we've messed with it. But the interesting thing is that, you know, you could really get overwhelmed by that, but if instead you say, you know, I wonder what I can do. I wonder what part I'm playing. Suddenly you feel powerful. And in the book, what I discovered was that many people who wound up doing great things, and I have all those kind of stories in the book, ordinary people who did things like started anti-bullying movement or helped stop the whale hunt or got Clorox to recycle Brita filters, several of the stories in the book, they were really people who just did something. They took one step. Almost none of them set out to do something grand. They just said, I wonder what's one step I can take. And so whether it's bringing more romance to my marriage or getting healthier in my life or changing my organization or changing something I care about in society, this simple principle of do something, do anything, because often what we do is we think, well, what I'm going to do is not enough. Well, don't worry about that. Just say, what can I do? What's one step I can take? Because that often then not only creates a ripple that others act, but it also gets you into the place of action instead of being a victim.
And it's so difficult for some people to understand that those steps in the middle are vitally important. Like when we say, I'm going to end domestic violence, you know, there's a lot of that going on now. And that's a whole lot of victimhood that's going on, too. And we could say that it's excuses and we can look at it from many different venues. But I'll tell you, having had several decades of history of that in my own, you know, ancestral line, it is not just something that you're going to click your fingers and it's going to stop tomorrow. But it is something that you as is happening now in the media, start bringing awareness to it so people will start looking at it. You know, it's so interesting. I was at you always say things, I always say random things happen to me or I notice random things. So I don't know, I was just having a conversation, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, with someone about domestic violence. And I said, okay, I need to go. I have to go to the store. I went to Walmart and I was looking at the glasses in the Walmart store. And I just happened to turn to my left and don't you know that there's a woman there with two black eyes? And I go, my word. You know, and it's so I think that once we raise our awareness or get something in our brain that is of importance to us, you'll start noticing it everywhere and then you'll be able to start helping it forward. I mean, she was probably there getting glasses because hers were broken, but she has black eyes now and it's like, I don't know. But, you know, you really have to take it a step forward and see what happens, you know, things you would never think will start coming around.
Yeah, you know, one of the I agree with you, and one of the stories in the book that I think really is most illustrative of the point that you're making is the story of two actually Canadian high school students who 8 years ago was the first day of school in their high school, and they were seniors in the high school, and a young ninth grader in his first day of high school was picked on and bullied all day long by three 12th grade bullies, verbally and physically, for one simple reason. He had worn a pink shirt to school that morning. And, you know, bullying is a huge problem, as a lot of people know. 150,000 American students on an average day will stay home out of fear of bullying, and about 5,000 to 6,000 teenage suicides in America every year attributable to bullying. So anyway, so this kid's picked on verbally and physically all day for his first day of high school. Ironically, they accused him of being a homosexual, but the reason he'd worn that, which of course is no reason to be bullied, of course, but it turns out he'd worn that pink shirt because his mother had survived breast cancer the year before, and he wore it in solidarity with his mother's journey. I'll make a long, beautiful story short. These two high school seniors heard about the incident. They didn't know the kid. They didn't witness it. They just heard about it on their way home. And they asked the question every person who's ever stepped up to make a difference asked themselves, I wonder what we can do about it. And the only thing they could think of is, well, let's go out tonight and get as many pink shirts and tank tops as we can, get a hold of as many of our friends as possible, and tomorrow morning when the bullies come to school, let them encounter a tsunami of pink. Let's show them that we are all against them.
Right.
Make a long story short, 300 of the 350 students showed up that day, many of the girls literally from head to toe wearing pink. Not only did they stop those bullies in their tracks, but after it got a lot of media attention, another high school student, not even these two young kids, said, you know, maybe we should start pink shirt days everywhere. And now, 8 years later, this past February, pink shirt days in at least 20 countries all over the world. And the point is that one day they just said, I wonder what we can do for this one kid who we don't know. And they took a chance, and look what happened. And so we never know the result of our work. And even if they only helped that one kid, and this is the point, that would have also been just as meaningful.
You know, absolutely, because you don't know the power of your eyes or your heart or your soul or your ears. And I say that, stop, look, and listen, you know. Are you looking? Are you listening? Are you paying attention? Are you present? And what are you seeing, you know? And that's the connection a lot of times. I know we live in the Deep South here, and it's so common to us. We could sit down at a table, you know, in a restaurant with 20 other people that we've never met before and just start a conversation within 5 minutes, and everybody's
right,
talking and laughing. But you can go to, you know, many other cities and states where that's really not exactly what is done or what is accepted, you know, in those areas. But, you know, so I think we're just used to it in certain venues where other people aren't used to it. So if you're not used to it, then it's an option to look at. If it's something you've done before, just continue to do it and move forward, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we actually surveyed people for my book, Stepping Up. And again, we'll get to, if some people are thinking, well, I want to talk about stepping up in my personal life. We'll get to that. But, you know, one of the interesting things is we surveyed people for the book. Why don't you step up more, you know, to do something about the things you care about? And not surprisingly, the number one reason was people said, you know, I'm only one person, I won't matter. And in the book, I talk about two things that counter that we all have to remember. And they're both in evidence in that pink shirt story. One is what I call the responsibility ripple, which is the moment one person decides to step up and take responsibility, it creates a ripple and challenges others to do the same. And it's also true in a relationship. When one person says, I'm going to start to act more civilly, I'm going to start being more romantic, even if my partner's not reciprocating right away, it changes the status quo. The second thing is, we forget about the power of aggregate influence. So if those two kids had stood up alone that day to the bully, bullies the next day, they probably would have been bullied themselves. But we forget the power of one times one times one times many where suddenly we have tremendous power, and that is everything from turning the lights out or the heat down to save energy, you know, to not using plastic bags at the grocery store, but bring your own cloth bags, or not getting a straw at a restaurant to reduce plastic. One person does that, it may not mean very much, but we forget the power of aggregate influence. And the funny thing about aggregate influence is, if one person drops out, and then you drop out, and I drop out, suddenly there isn't the influence. So one person, on the one hand, doesn't make any difference, but on the one hand, one person is all that matters, because one times many doesn't happen if one doesn't step up. It's almost like a Zen riddle. But the bottom line is, one person is maybe all that matters for those two reasons.
And that's also taking you back to your five levels of responsibility. I mean, because, you know, the five rows, because that's a similar thing, that's exactly what you're saying, right?
Yeah, exactly. I talk in the book about this, the five rows of influence, and, you know, from a wonderful story of an experience I had on an airplane where, you know, everyone was in a grumpy, foul mood and nasty. The flight attendants were in a bad mood. And about halfway through the flight, this little boy who was about 2 years old had stood up on his mother's lap and looked back at all of us and just smiled. And within a few, you know, moments, he transformed the mood of the five rows behind him. Eventually, he was actually back there in row six playing, and the flight attendants came up and were laughing with him. And the point is, a light bulb kind of went off in my head that, you know, most of us only influence about five rows around us. And if we could focus on what we can control, and in our five rows, then that's all we can do. And if we do that, almost every problem we face in the world, from bullying to abuse to climate change to understanding between people of different religions, is a five rows problem. It requires every one of us in our five rows to do what we can, and then aggregately we make a difference. And yet we spend so much time talking about what someone else needs to do, you know, ranting. I always tell people, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, when you find yourself ranting about something, just remember, ranting about what other people should do will ultimately do nothing but ruin your health and your psychological well-being.
Right.
Instead of ranting about what other people should do about something, ask what I call, again, the two magic questions. What part am I playing, and what can I do? And notice the shift that happens. And by the way, when your friend comes and complains to you about their spouse or some problem at work, or, you know, instead of commiserating with them for hours on end, say, you know what, you're right. I wish they would change, whoever they are, but I wonder what part we are playing or you are playing, and I wonder what you can or I can do about it. Suddenly the energy shifts, and it's in a way incredibly empowering. And because of the five rows, it also makes a huge difference ultimately in the challenge we face together.
And sometimes I think a lot of these people that have the rant, or they have the excuses or the reasons or justifications or validation or whatever it is because they're really looking for that inside themselves. You know, they're really looking at themselves and saying, I need to know that you hear me. I need to know that you're listening to me, or I need to speak this out so maybe I can rationalize it, or maybe I'm just telling you because I don't feel like doing it. I mean, there's a zillion different ways to have an excuse, a reason, or validation, or judgment.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, look, ranting is natural, you know, as human beings. You know, we shouldn't probably be so hard on ourselves. Even saying, I wish someone else would change, is natural. The problem is, it isn't helpful to us psychologically. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is a psychologist named Rotter in 1957 who came up with this instrument that measures whether each one of us is what I call an innie or an outie. And the bottom line is, innies are people that whenever something happens to them or someone else, they figure pretty much you manifested it in some way. So why didn't you get good grades in class? Well, I guess I didn't study hard enough. Why didn't you get the promotion? Well, I guess I didn't network and meet the right people. Why do some people get ahead in life? Well, they work hard. Outies, on the other hand, why do some people get ahead? Well, they're lucky. Why didn't you get good grades in the class? Well, the teacher wasn't good. Why didn't you get the promotion? Well, the boss had a favorite. I wasn't it. Now, here's the interesting thing. Sometimes there are things outside of ourselves that influence. Some of us, for example, had great parents who were great mentors. Other people had parents who gave them a sword they had to overcome. Some people are lucky. They got a golden spoon or whatever it was. But here's the interesting thing. Is we know since 1957, we've two interesting things. One is we know that university students are becoming more outies every decade. since 1957, which means we're becoming a society, not just university students, of people who tend to focus on the things that we can't control as to why things are happening to us. The second thing is we know now that if you're an innie, meaning every time something happens, you ask, I wonder what part I'm playing and I wonder what I can do about it, you will be more successful, more likely to be promoted, be healthier, have fewer bouts of unhappiness, and have better personal relationships than people who are outies. And it doesn't mean, of course, that there aren't things outside of ourselves, because the truth is, it's an innie and an outie world, but you'll never get ahead or be happy if you focus on the things you can't control. So we know now from this research that people who are out innies and look, I wonder what part I'm playing, what can I do, are simply happier and have better relationships and are more successful. So again, it's really a choice we can make to say, hey, I know there are things that influence my success that I can't control, but what can I do with what I have, which is always the path to greatness in any endeavor in one's life.
And I think that's really been a generational thing, because the last several decades, I think we've had a whole lot of changes recently where people are saying, you know, remember it used to be the I generation, it used to be the we generation, you know, all those crazy things, right? So really people were trudging through life and, you know, they didn't care who they took, you know, as a hostage. They just kind of barreled through life. And I don't think we really could have had this great conversation that we're having this evening, you know, probably 30, 40 years ago, because the words we're saying about taking responsibility and you can create change, people would look at you like you had 10 heads. I know in the 70s, it was a concept. It wasn't a movement. You know, it was an idea. It wasn't something that you could actually put your hand on and hammer down as, you know, what you could do today. So I think really it's taken people a while and the world to just have different shifts in what exactly is going on in the world and the part they do play in it. So it's really been, you know, it comes right along with the decade, don't you think?
I think so. And I think it's really fascinating that we've made this shift, right, where we're feeling more and more like victims, more and more like the things that really influence our lives, are beyond our control. But when we decide to move into a place of control, again, we're happier and in a place of empowerment. So again, people should not think of taking responsibility as like this burden. It's freeing. Mm-hmm. Great example. Let's say if you got someone listening who's a parent of a teenager. Your teenager comes home and says, let's say they're not doing well in school with a particular teacher. And they come home and say, Mom, Dad, this is not a good teacher. It's the teacher. It's not me. Now, let's say you've had a parent-teacher conference with the teacher, and you know this is not the best teacher your kid's ever going to have. So on the bell curve of teachers, and I'm, you know, my partner's a teacher, so I know that, you know, not all teachers are created equal, not all pilots are created equal, not the best teacher. Here's the question as a parent you ought to ask yourself. Am I doing a favor for my son or daughter by enabling them, saying, oh, you're right, that's not a very good teacher? Instead, what I should say is, you know what? I don't know if it's the best teacher or the worst teacher you're ever going to have, but all through your life you're going to have bosses, teachers, other people who are not going to be exactly how you'd like them to be. So what part do you think you're playing in what's going on with you and the teacher, and what do you think you can do about it? Because, see, what we're teaching our children is to be in a place of responsibility instead of blaming the outside for ourselves. So there's all kinds of subtle ways as parents, and I've done that with my daughter, you know, when she was growing up, and I think it makes a big difference when we do that, when we actually role model that with our kids instead of enabling them to be in a victim place. You know, you're right. Maybe it's not the best teacher you're ever going to have, but what do you think you can do to work within what you have in front of you?
And also that, and you say in your book about praising for effort, not just results. You have to, that's a super fine line that parents have to pass through these days. I mean, I know I'm almost 60, so I know, you know, when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, it was not about, they just wanted to know, bottom line, what's the end result? You know,
I paused for a minute when you said you were almost 60 because I realized, my God, I'm 56. I'm almost 62. It's frightening in some ways and rewarding in other ways. But I don't know about you. I never imagined I would be saying I'm almost 60. But indeed, as
That's
you,
right.
I'm almost 60. In fact, you stopped me so much at the dollar you asked, because I've just got stuck on that for a month.
Well, you know, like a long time ago, when you and I grew up, you know, it wasn't about, you know, oh, well, I studied really hard, this is all I did, look at all my effort. It was really about, did you get the A? Don't talk to me unless you got the A. You know, I'm sure we've all had parents like that. But then
now it's gotten
to the point where, you know, like at Little League, they give you a certificate for, you know, hey, he was great this day. Oh, hey, he had his uniform on straight that day. Or, hey, he had, you know, he was always on time. And it's just so somebody would get something. And so it's really a fine line about how do you balance between those two things? Because, you know, that's a teeter-totter that really will slap you right in the face if you just walk off for 1 second, right?
Yeah, you know, it's a really fine line, actually. And as you know, I will make a confession. I'm one of those folks who's made fun of in a subtle way, not a mean way. You know what this the self-esteem mm-hmm. generation that you know we've kind of overdone praise, and so I hear in the workplace all the time because I give about 70 talks inside corporations every year and consult to big companies. And, you know, one of the things that I hear often is, a lot of the young people, they're great. They're so confident, but sometimes they're overconfident, right? So they think they're actually, you know, maybe know more than they do or are better than.
Oops, we lost him. Maybe he will try it back. So John will be right back with us. And in the meantime, if you'd like to find out more information about John's book, his book is Stepping Up, How Taking Responsibility Changes Everything. And he is also a best-selling author of The 5 Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die. And it is Dr. John Izzo. He is a PhD. He is a speaker and an author, and he's absolutely the greatest because, really, he speaks to a lot of companies, bit large and small businesses. And it's very important because when you find that out, you say, oh, this is great, you know. I can take a few tips from here, and maybe this is how I'll be able to live my life, you know. I can make some changes. I can try something else. But we're also talking about making the small changes in life, and it's not always about the end results that are absolutely, you know, hey, I'm going to be the top of the heap and I'm going to accomplish all this. It's about everybody doing their part all around, so taking a small responsibility. So, John, you back with us?
I'm back, and I'm sorry. Yes, so what I was saying about this fine line is, that I was kind of one of those people who used to make fun of this kind of, you know, overpraise. And then I started studying, and I talk about this research in my book, some fascinating research at Stanford around the fact that when you praise people for results, and kids in particular as well, that that they're more likely to take risk and try things when they're praised for effort, not just results. And I give you a real example of that. One of my best friends has 2 children. I've kind of been an uncle to them because, you know, I've grown up with them over the years. And one, the son, who's the older, is, you know, an athlete and was, you know, a very accomplished soccer player, you know, on, region-wide teams, et cetera. And the younger daughter, you know, the daughter was, you know, more artsy, or, you know, in her orientation, not really a big athlete, but she really, you know, admired her brother. So she started playing soccer. And she really wasn't doing that great at it, but, you know, she was hanging in there. And one day my friend Jeremy called me out of the blue and said, hey, John, I'm so excited. Emily got a trophy for soccer. And I said, oh, is that her first trophy? He goes, no, she's got like a room full of trophies, but this is the first one she did anything to deserve.
Oh, wow.
And the funny thing is, I had just been studying and writing about this research at Stanford, and a light bulb went off in my head that by getting rewarded for her effort, and we can debate, should everyone get a trophy, all those things, but here's the point.
Mm-hmm.
She was praised for her effort, that she was getting slowly better at soccer. Because of that, she didn't quit. She stayed with it. The praise for effort, instead of just praising the people who were scoring goals all the time, by the coaches also praising those who were making effort and progress, kept her, no pun intended, in the game until, guess what? She actually became a good soccer player. And to me, the light bulb went off in my head around that Stanford research in a very pragmatic way. This is a good example of it. So it's not that we shouldn't be praising those who are scoring the goals or getting A's. It's that we also have to be praising the effort and the small progress that happens, because if I'm praised for small effort and progress, guess what? I'm willing to take more risk. That's what the research at Stanford shows. Fascinating research. Again, if people are interested, you know, it's in the book, and you really begin to realize how it's, again, it's not an either or. So I've stopped making fun as much as I used to about that, you know, fact that we're giving trophies to everybody, because I've now kind of seen how it has some important impacts in a positive way. Here's a good example of that. Let's say you want your husband to be more romantic, right? And he makes some fledgling efforts that you think are still pretty inadequate. So now he's gone from a 1 in romance to a 3. I can tell you, as a man, because I have women friends saying, I wish men would be more attentive, more romantic, and men have their own complaints about women, is that if you praise him for the small effort that he made, they went from a 1 to a 3, he's more likely to work hard to go to a 5. Same thing for a wife. Same thing for someone at work, right? So I think people then get it. Oh, I see it. If I go, well, you're still a 3. Well, am I going to want to take a risk and try and get to a 5? Probably not. If you say, hey, wow, it's really great, you did that, here's some other ideas, right?
Right, and then we've spoken on this show before about this topic, and we've also said, too, don't try to always be a mouse and looking for crumbs. You really need to look for the loaf of bread. So sometimes, you know, when you're really all the time getting, you know, you're hoping you get that praise back, and then maybe you'll raise up, you know, from a 3 to a 5. A lot of times, you know, men or women or whatever the situation is, they might stop at that point and say, got her off my back, now I'm on to the next thing, you know?
And that's a different thing. So I think what we want to do is not, good point, not to confuse those two things, right?
Correct.
Why I said we don't stop praising those who are scoring the goals or getting the A's,
right?
Or who are a 10 out of 10 in romance, right? We don't necessarily lower the bar. But what we're doing is we're realizing that, this is an important element, you know, of it. And also, if you think about it, if we want people to take more responsibility, we actually have to praise them for the responsibility they do take. Like, you know, when we surveyed people, why don't you step up more at work? You know, one of the most common reasons is people said, hey, I don't step up at work because, you know, I did, and I kind of got my head chopped off, right, for taking a risk.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another example of you know, if we want people to take responsibility, we have to watch what we do when they do, you know, and so that we send the right message.
Absolutely. So that brings us right into talking about leadership. A lot of people say, what is leadership? Is it, the bigger paycheck, the top of the, you know, the tower or whatever? Or sometimes you'll have a group of people and they'll say, we need a leader. And someone will say, I'll take it, and where do they go? But they stand up high around a podium, and a lot of people are saying, really? You know, what does that really mean? What does leadership really mean?
Yeah, and, you know, one of my, and of course I've been kind of studying leadership for, a long time, for the last 20, 23, 25 years now. I've been, you know, working with companies all over the world on leadership and how do we create, you know, better leaders. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that leadership is not a position. You know, leadership is a choice to step up and to, make a bigger difference. And so, as you said, sometimes, you know, we're saying, well, you know, when I have this. This is, by the way, one of the ways we know we're not taking responsibility. For example, someone will say, you know, if they ever promote me around here, I'll show them what I'm made of. Well, hint.
Yeah.
How about show them what you're made of? People say, if I only had this, I would do that. Well, instead, say, here's what I'm going to do with what I have. And, yeah, it would be great if I had more responsibility, more of a position, et cetera. So it's kind of a bit of a paradox, but leadership is, you know, Arthur Ashe, the great tennis player, said, to achieve greatness, you must start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can. And so part of leadership is saying, you know, whatever position I have, whatever I'm doing, you know, I'm going to make a difference here. And, you know, one of my favorite stories in the book is the story of the Starbucks Frappuccino, you know, and how it was invented. not by the corporate marketing team, but, you know, really two frontline employees in a small Starbucks store in Santa Monica that noticed that regular customers weren't coming in as often. And it wasn't in their job description to find new products, but when the customer said, well, you know, it's too hot in L.A. this summer for hot coffee, and there's a local coffee shop got this iced coffee drink, you know, and we love it, you know, they on their own time went and tasted the drink. They dragged their manager down. They dogged the regional manager at Starbucks after Starbucks said no, not once but twice. The employees and the frontline manager went rogue and just got some blenders and started mixing some stuff together to see if they could make this drink work. And the rest is history, you know, several billions of dollars profit later. But, and by the way, they were all rewarded. But what were they rewarded for? They were rewarded for choosing to be leaders, even though it wasn't in their position. Those frontline people did not have create new products for Starbucks in their description, but they chose to lead. And to me, it's a great, you know, a quintessential example of what it means to choose to be a leader, whatever your position is.
And, you know, I think sometimes, too, when people say, I'm in the job, and they always say J-O-B, and they say, well, it's not working for me, and they've got a list of excuses. Well, I always like to, you know, I always say with their health, that's where we usually get into this conversation. I'll say, well, what if you didn't have that job? And they would say, and they'd go on to this glorious story of, I would love to do this. Do you think I could just make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and give them out to the homeless? Or can I just invent some super cookie and, you know, all the kids at schools will have their breakfast in a cookie or whatever. And then you have to really, that's about, and I think your book correlates with this because that is stepping up. That's stepping up to say that this J-O-B that I have isn't where I should be, and I need to be somewhere else. So it's taking responsibility for what your soul is really telling you, your heart, that you want to do so that you know that you can help others in a better way. Because you, as you, at your J-O-B, is just, it's almost like glue on your shoes. Gum on your shoes. You know, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah, very, very true. I completely, agree with what you're saying. And, you know, so often, again, you know, I think we surrender our power in a
right.
variety of ways.
And I think getting your power back is exactly what your responsibility is. It's required. They go hand in hand. I mean, if you don't really feel you have power, that's where you need to start first, don't you think?
Yeah. I come back to, you know, what can I do with what I have? What part am I playing? What can I do about it? Right. These very simple questions that begin to, you know, get us in a different place and do something, do anything. You know, that's why I think that's such an important chapter in the book. You know, just what's one thing I can do, you know, to move in the direction of what I want or to address something I care about, you know, and it just is, you know, something profound happens. You know, one of the things that, you know, I've been a lifelong, you know, passionate about the environment, you know, all my life. And, you know, I think what we've done to it is, you know, will be probably the great kind of travesty of our generation. And one of the things is the ocean is literally choking in plastic garbage. And I was so overwhelmed by this, but a couple years ago, you know, I said, well, I wonder what I can do. Well, I live by the water. I live near the ocean. I said, well, I can make it my mission wherever I'm on a beach, whenever I'm near the ocean, that I will make sure no plastic goes into the ocean, whatever I have to do to clean it up, et cetera. And, you know, it felt so empowering to do that. I said, well, I wonder what else I can do. And then I said, well, I guess I could give up the three things that are the three most common types of plastic that wind up in the ocean. You know, which is plastic straws, plastic shopping bags, and plastic water bottles. You know, when I was in university,
right.
Nobody had a plastic water bottle, literally no one. And yet we wound up, you know, being fine. And so the interesting thing is at about 98% level, I've actually given up those things for the last 3 years and now gotten about 45,000 people at last count to take that pledge to do the same. But the point is, I felt so much more powerful instead of, you know, just getting depressed about the fact that the oceans were choking on this, you know, millions and tons of plastic, to just say, I wonder what I can do, right? And so this is, again, again and again, the point is, what can I do? One of my other favorite stories in the book is a group of frontline employees who were bothered by the fact that there was no work-life balance in their company, and everyone kept saying the boss needs to do this, the owner needs to do this. And so finally, these two employees just started meeting once a week and asking themselves, I wonder what we can do. We can't change anybody else, we can change ourselves. First week, all they could agree was they wouldn't email each other on weekends. Second week, they said they would agree that they wouldn't schedule a meeting after 5 o'clock. They might have to go to one, but they wouldn't schedule one. Within 3 months, they had 50 people meeting with them once a week. And the owners and the managers of the company eventually adopted about, 12 or 15 of the policies that these guys had informally started. But look how it started. It started with two people just saying, we can't change anybody else, but we can change ourselves. And suddenly it created a momentum.
Yeah, because you also have a chapter in the book, like, who am I to step up? Because everybody has a voice, and that's so important. We like to say that, sometimes, we'll do the little things, but how important is that? That's so about validation. So if we have power and validation, I think that really skyrocket almost anybody to say, I can step up, I can be a leader, I can be a teacher, I can share something. And I think teaching is the greatest thing. What does teaching mean? It just means showing somebody something else that you may know or you may share or you may have found out or something you've recognized. It's just passing along information. You don't have to have a teacher as, somebody who went to school. Same thing with doctor. We always talk about this on the, on the show. If you turn around and you help the person next to you, just walking across the street, that's as much as an occupational therapist does. I'm helping you walk down the street. So we have to know that everything we do is valid, and we do have power in doing that.
Well, exactly. It's ultimately incredibly important that we do it. It's not actually, the history is shaped by millions of individuals who just choose to do something. And the other interesting thing, this thing about who am I to step up, right, is that every person I talk to who wound up making a difference had that thought. I think of Mike Feinberg, who, along with a colleague, began the KIPP schools, charter schools in inner cities all across America now. But it all began when these two young teachers were incredibly frustrated about the inability in their Houston school, inner city school, to see progress. And one of the interesting things is, I love what Mike said to me. He said, every time you think about stepping up and doing anything, there are two voices in your head. The one voice says, who are you to step up? You don't have the credentials. You don't have the talent. It's not going to work. People are going to make fun of you, whatever it is. He said the other voice is, why not? Why not you? You may fail, but failure is not the worst thing that can happen to you, and on and on. And he said that first voice is not your friend. He said don't make friends with that voice, because every person who ever stepped up to make a difference, whether it was to save a marriage or to help an individual or to create a Frappuccino or to stop the whale hunt, like a story I tell in the book, or start an anti-bullying movement, had that thought. Who am I to do this? I have a different question. Who am I not to do this? Why not me? Because one of the things I discover and talk about in the book is that passion is always more important than pedigree. And again and again, so many wonderful stories in the book of ordinary people who did not have the pedigree but had the passion and determination to wind up doing really interesting and amazing things. The great book, by the way, Stepping Up is a great book for young people. I have a lot of people, my corporate clients, say they left the book around the house and then couldn't get it back because their 16-year-old son or 16-year-old daughter swiped the book and said, you're not getting this back. So a great – and by the way, that's, if you have a teenager, don't buy the book for them. Buy it and leave it around the house in a visible place. And what's going to happen is they're going to go, stepping up, I'm taking responsibility, changes everything. That's interesting, right? You give it to them, they'll likely go, there's mom or dad doing that again.
Absolutely. I have four kids, but they're in their 20s and 30s. They're a little bit older, and they're on their way.
You can send it to them, right? At that age, you can send it to them because they actually think you know something now. So now you can send it to them, right? But not when they're teenagers.
I'm still in the not smart category.
Okay. Well, I hear you.
The decade's changing, So that takes us right back to right around the circle again when we said, you know, if you're a stay-at-home mom and you're now baking cookies, it's all about passion. It's about stepping up and making that change and how vitally important that is. You know, I think back on websites. Now, I know this is kind of a crazy analogy, but, you know, I've had a website probably since 1990s, 98 or 90, something like that. And if we remember the old time websites, it was super hard to figure out how the heck to do those things. And we had to hire somebody and, oh my gosh, I'm not going to get it on the internet, or how is it going to do that? And you know, it was just a long drawn out drama. You could have drama for days and weeks and months about that. But now you turn around, you can have a website done in 2 hours. You know, you could have it up on Facebook and social media in less than 20 minutes. I mean, I did it the other day. I put up 3 Twitter pages, 3 emails, and a Hootsuite, and then we were going to look at logging into the website. I did all that in 15 minutes. And so it really, things change, you know, because as you start going forward and learning more things, you may say, I really want to work on, you know, the plastic in the ocean. But going to clean up the plastic on the beach, you may see something greater or something more appealing to you, and you can shift your direction. Because you'll say, you know, I think I'm be much better over here. That's so interesting, and I would want to have, you know, much more of an effect there. So we have ways. You can always change direction. No matter how you start, you can always change and alter. So, you know, when we say taking steps, the steps are just up. The steps don't always have to be in a straight line.
Yeah, exactly. And usually they're not. Not only don't they have to be, they're usually not. And, you know, I kind of, you know, before I wrote the book Stepping Up, I wrote a book called The 5 Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die, which was a Biography Channel and PBS TV series in which I'd interviewed these 250 people from the age of 60 to 106 who had been identified as the wisest person that they knew. Actually, we asked them, who's the one older person you know who has found true happiness and has something to teach us? And when I interviewed those people, you know, and of course there are 5 things I discovered, can't go into them all, but one of the things that I really discovered was that, you know, even taking responsibility for your own happiness is a really critical act. One of the things that these people, you know, said to me again and again is, you know, happiness is not out there. We think it's out there, but it's actually inside. It's a choice to be content. It's a choice to be in the moment. It's a choice to claim your power instead of the things that you can't do, right? And I think this is what I saw, and you know, all my life I've tried to go out and find stories. You know, so in the 5 Secrets, the stories of older people who had found happiness, sustainable happiness, and stepping up, people who had stepped up to take responsibility and the impact it had on the world and on their lives. And I think that one of the things is, you know, we got to learn from the people who figured it out. You know, life is so short. There's no owner's manual when you show up, you know, and they say the school of hard knocks is the best place to learn. I love, there's a great Confucius quote. Confucius say there are three paths to wisdom. The first path is reflection, which is the noblest. So you can read books and study and meditate all your life. It's a noble path. The second is experience, and he said that is the bitterest path. So you can learn from making lots of mistakes, but it's a pretty bitter path. He said the third path to wisdom is imitation, meaning not being yourself, but meaning find the stories of others who are happy, find the story of those who have stepped up, and say, how can I do that in my life? And so in many ways, my work, these books, are about trying to find where it's working and what can we learn from it so we don't have to go through all that bad experience when so many other people have taken the path for us and we can say, what can we learn from them? So, you know, part of this is being open to that. We have a natural resistance, I think, to doing that because we want to do it our way and learn for ourselves, but yeah. Sometimes we don't have to.
And I think also, too, a lot of people let's say in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, they've run their life. They've done it a certain way. This is their way they've always done it. This is the results they've always gotten. They're stuck in their way or whatever it is. And sometimes when you ask, I've asked several people at end of life discussions we've had, and I would say to them, who was your greatest teacher too? And do you know what they would say is the ones that were really ran their life hard and fast, they would say, a newborn baby is my greatest mm-hmm. teacher because it teaches mm-hmm. me patience, mm-hmm. softness, and mm-hmm. quietness. And that's so vitally important to remember, is that all really, that's all that really matters. It doesn't matter about all of that other running hard and whatever you did or blah, blah, blah. You know, that's going to be on your obituary. It's really about were you, you know, being able to pay attention to people around you, and did you just not, you know, you can't take victims along the way. You have to be able to be kind and gentle and peaceful along your way. So, John, I think we have come to the end of the show. Would you like to share with us about your events coming up and about your website and where they could purchase your book? And also, you tell us a little bit about your other book. Oh, dear. Did we lose John again?
Yeah. So, you know, I've written 6 books, actually. So, you know, the 2 most recent ones, Stepping Up and The 5 Secrets You Must Discover Before You Die. People can get them on Amazon, Google Books, you know, for your iPad. You know, they're pretty much available in every format that the Kindle, you know, every format that's out there, the book is pretty much available. So Amazon, a great place to start. You know, my website is www.drjohnizzo.com. That's just drjohnizzo.com. So drjohnizzo.com. And if people just Google John Izzo, I-Z-Z-O, they'll find me. And, you know, I don't do a lot of public events, but we have videos and things that are available on the website. And if people work for a company or an association and they're interested in having me come in, that's quite possible. But if you sign up on the website, we have actually every 2 weeks I send out a video, just a short 2-3 minute video on some interesting things that we've discovered about success and happiness and about great organizations. And if people want to sign up for that, they can do that, you know, right on the website. And then they will know, you know, if I have events coming up, which I do here and there, public events. But both these books, great gifts for yourself and great gifts for, you know, somebody in your life that you care about. And, you know, I've been lucky. You know, I've gotten to speak all over the world and influence a lot of people's lives, and I'm very grateful for that. And I hope people will read the book. I think they will find one of the 2 books. I think they will find something in there for themselves if they've enjoyed what we've talked about today.
Well, John, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it, and keep up your good work. And again, I want to just go back to, you know, remind people of just that last thing that I said, something I said earlier, the 2 magic questions. What part am I playing and what can I do about it? And remember that voice that tells you you can't step up, it's not your friend. Don't make a bedroom for them. You can make a difference. You do make a difference. And when you step up and take responsibility, everything does change because you change.
And everything starts to fall into place pretty quickly thereafter.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to find out more information about John Izzo or to purchase his book, please do check out on the bottom of today's show page description is the link to his website. And you'll be able to click in directly to be able to find out more information about his work, about his other book that is also there, and also sign up and be able to get his newsletter where you'll be able to find out more information. As he said, he sends something out every 2 weeks, and hey, you know, you can get it on that list. So it's really great to have you with us today. I know taking responsibility is a really big word, or stepping up, but I will guarantee you it is worth doing. But when you feel that you have all those blocks and you're super stuck, it's really hard to go forward, and you will incur, or potentially most people incur, a lot of health risks. If that is the case, you can please contact me. It is drjeanettegallagher.com. You can also send me a message directly through Blog Talk Radio, the show page, or you can also just Google my name. It's on the show page, and you'll find out my other websites. We're also going to be possibly talking about some other things this week on health and being able to stand in your power. Last night we had a talk about She. It was the name of the book. It was about women having the power in their greatness and being able to accept themselves for who they are, but also to validate themselves and know that they are nurturing and magical, and they are able to be able to take on all of these great factors, but still be a great woman. You know, I think the world is really hard sometimes these days, and really this show has really been a focus about validating that you do have your power, you do be able to take care of yourself, and we're here to help you with any struggles. So thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher for Sedona Talk Radio, and see you again tomorrow. Thank you.